Take a network break. Stock your favorite safe space with virtual donuts and sit back and enjoy our weekly dash through this week's tech news. We're talking about lawsuits, acquisitions, new products, and more. I'm Drew Conroy-Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow. This week's show is being sponsored by Interop ITX, the only independent conference for technology leaders. It's taking place May 15th through the 19th in Las Vegas. You can get a year's worth of objective IT education in just 1 week. Visit interopitx.com and use the promo code PacketPushers for a 20% discount. Network Break is also brought to you by INE. INE has an incredible library of over 8,500 network training videos designed for the network engineer. Offerings include Cisco CCENT and CCIE, plus there's Wireshark, Juniper, and more. Get 15% off any product or an all-access pass by going to ine.com/packet and using the code PACKET. All right, jumping into the news, chipmaker Qualcomm, they're being sued both by the U.S. Federal Trade Commission and Apple for aggressive patent licensing. Greg, what is going on here?
One of my favorite topics, patents and FRAND.
So, yes, FRAND. We'll have to explain that in a minute.
Yeah, that's right. So in this case, it looks like Apple and Qualcomm did a unique deal where Apple committed to buying Qualcomm processors, baseband modems in their chips. Now, the baseband modem is the thing that drives the 3G, the 4G, and so forth and so on, for which Apple paid royalties. So Qualcomm makes the chips. But they also did an exclusive deal where money was exchanging hands. Now, apparently, there's been a bit of a dust-up, and Qualcomm has been saying that Apple hasn't been doing something right, and now Apple's counter-suing Qualcomm for charging too much for something.
Right.
It's very confusing.
It is very confusing. And Apple's suit actually came after the FTC suit, although it looks like Apple may have been talking to the FTC because I think Apple might have been referenced in the FTC lawsuit that they issued. But essentially, the FTC is saying, hey, Qualcomm, you're essentially maintaining a monopoly on these baseband processors, and that's not right, and so you got to stop it.
And Qualcomm has a long reputation for anti-competitive practices, right? So back in the early days of 2G, Qualcomm had its own custom proprietary version of 2G standards and 3G standards, and it went out and forced companies like Verizon and so forth to sign up to their proprietary signaling equipment, their towers and so forth. And Qualcomm was trying to create a global monopoly around this, but everybody then swung away to 3G and left Qualcomm stranded. Qualcomm did get a lot of support from the US government. This is all on the record. This is all well known. The result was that Qualcomm eventually lost out because they'd spent all this money developing this technology, expecting to take over the world. And people around the rest of the world sort of turned away from them and went, no, we're just going to go with the open source stuff because it's cheaper and just as good. For Qualcomm to be doing this doesn't strike me as surprising. Qualcomm has a long history of using dubious, very sharp-nosed business arrangements. Can we say that?
Sure.
And then often it comes unstuck down the line, so short-term thinking. So in this case, Apple has filed a lawsuit that seeks $1 billion in damages from Qualcomm for charging excessive royalty fees, and particularly for technologies that don't pertain to Qualcomm.
Ah. That's a nice business model.
Yeah, it's pretty sharp business practice if you could get into it. But it seems to have been triggered by the fact that the FTC statement drove this, and then Apple's responded. And then Apple doubled down this week. I'll try and find the show note. So not only did it sue Qualcomm in the US, it's also lodged a brief in Chinese law for another $250
million. Wow. And that's the part of it I wasn't aware of. Yeah. That's funny.
They're not fighting them on just one front. So let's just talk about this is what's in from the Motley Fool. Apple filed a blockbuster lawsuit against its most important supplier, Qualcomm. And that's true. Qualcomm has been historically a very important supplier. But increasingly, Apple's been diversifying its baseband silicon away. It has been using Qualcomm chips, but it's also been using Cirrus chips and some rumors about Broadcom as well. So they've got multiple of these baseband chips in the market now, which gives them the chance to walk away from Qualcomm. Qualcomm was intended to enhance their monopoly power over the baseband processor market, and the suit came just after the US FTC filed a similar regulatory antitrust complaint against the mobile chip giant. Apple is now taking its grievances to the Middle Kingdom, in other words, China. So Apple has filed not one, but two suits against Qualcomm in Beijing. That's
wow.
New.
That is new, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so an Apple statement that I read says that, quote, Qualcomm insists on charging Apple at least 5 times more in payments than all the other cellular patent licensors we have agreements with combined.
Mm.
That's a lot of money.
Well, there's this thing called fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory licensing.
Yes, that's FRAND, what we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, and that's actually a big foundation for many of these big companies. So all of these big companies have massive patent portfolios, and basically what they agree is that they'll license them to each other on fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory terms. So if everybody started suing each other about these patents and applying capitalist principles of go in hard and get everything you can out of them. You know, kill them. Who cares if they're a customer? We just want their money. You know, that sort of stuff. That would actually lead to like an all-out legal war with just vast amounts of money just wasted in patent litigation. So there was sort of a cordial detente put together about 5 years ago where they all said, well, you know, let's just get together and do some fair and reasonable licensing so that everybody can get on with making products, which is where the real money is. And if Qualcomm's been going against that, I suspect that we're going to see more of these suits.
That was part of the FTC's complaint that they said that Qualcomm made commitments to license some of these essential patents under FRAND or fair, reasonable, non-discriminatory terms, but in fact hasn't lived up to that commitment. So essentially, yeah, when you've got standards bodies trying to operate, people kind of throw their patents on the table and say, we'll put it under this FRAND deal so that we're not shooting each other in the face.
Yes. Well, this is important because the IEEE, and to a much lesser extent, the ITF doesn't usually get involved in FRAND technologies. They just ignore them. But the IEEE, the main reason that companies participate in the IEEE is that they can take their patents there and make money out of them. So you see lots of delays coming out of the IEEE as companies try to say, our proprietary patented technology is better than your proprietary patented technology. Once you get it in there, you can make money from it. So companies actually don't fight on getting the best outcome for customers. What they fight on is getting the most revenue for their customers. And that just causes delays and distortions in the technology market that really nobody wants to see. But at the end of the day, FRAND is key. People don't mind getting access to someone else's technology if it's gooder and better and so forth, as long as they're not being ripped off. Like I said, it's just a gentleman's agreement between these companies to be nice to each other when it comes to patents. And they've all got to invest in patents. And there's numbers like, you know, I've got this many patents and you've got this many patents, therefore we won't pay each other because it evens out, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of why, you know, you see so many US companies buying up patent portfolios and all that sort of stuff when companies go broke, is because that gives them negotiating positions when FRAND negotiations come along. Qualcomm's breaking that down, then it could have wide-ranging impacts across the market. So I suspect Apple's taking this on because if it's overpaid by $1 billion, it's not known for its nice behavior when its suppliers.
Apple is not a shrinking violet, we will say.
No. And also, I was just thinking about it, you know, like Apple's moved very, very fast here. I would expect that they've known about this. To lodge briefs within a few days of the FTC complaint suggests that this isn't a surprise to Apple and this has been in the making for some time. And also the fact that Apple has diversified away from Qualcomm basebands.
Right. What I read in some of the stories that came across the browser was that Qualcomm had already been sued last year by South Korea over similar issues, and the year before in China, again, over patenting and licensing. So it seems like there's been some run-up here, and now the US and Apple are getting in on the game.
Yep. Very sticky business. So I doubt if it'll have much short-term impact, but the long-term impact on Qualcomm could be significant.
Well, I read a story in Forbes that says approximately 2/3 of Qualcomm's profits come from licensing royalties. So if there is any significant change here, that is going to hurt.
Yep, and probably couldn't happen to nicer people. Given their history.
Yes. All right, well, we'll keep an eye on the story, and if more developments arise, we shall talk about them. But moving on, Cisco Systems is spending $3.7 billion to acquire a startup called AppDynamics. They make software to monitor application performance. And the interesting thing, Cisco bought the company like just before it was scheduled to go public. So I'm assuming that means it paid a premium.
The article has been widely reported all across the media, Bloomberg, ARS Technica, and another one from a company called Axios, which we'll talk about in a minute. So let's just talk about what this means to Cisco. So it was bought by the IoT business unit. This is not an enterprise play. So there is an enterprise business unit inside of Cisco. This is not an enterprise product. It's not being added to the SDN portfolio. It's about growing the IoT market. So in addition to the $1.2 billion it spent on Jasper about a year and a half ago, it's now buying $3.7 billion worth of AppDynamics to buy growth there. Now, the software itself is about app performance. So when you develop your software, you put this software inside of it as it's being written, and it starts to collect metrics about your software performance. And it does a bit of infrastructure. So it can do a little bit of database performance by monitoring how fast your database is performing queries and requests. And it'll do some server monitoring. That's not what the product's about. It's about getting inside of, you know, your Java, inside of your PHP and your Node and, you know, all that stuff, and then giving you deep analytics about user performance and application performance.
Right.
So that's not Cisco's core business.
Not at all. Not at all.
There's no hardware here. There's no enterprise. This is a completely new area for Cisco. So if you recall, I think I see this as validation of my commentary over the last year or so, which is Cisco doesn't see the enterprise as a growing market. They see IoT, and now they're making an acquisition, a very substantial acquisition, to grow the IoT business. So just put that on the table. Let's see how it works out. Now, that's been validated by the fact that the CEO, Wadhwani, will be reporting directly to Cisco's IoT and apps boss, Rowan Trollope. Okay? So he won't be reporting to the head of the enterprise business unit, which sort of is my point writ large. You know, because the technology covers complex enterprise platforms such as, and I'm quoting, JMS, queuing technologies, TIBCO, web methods, etc., it's not an infrastructure play in the least. So it does a whole bunch of really neat things that the enterprise tech infrastructure market needs, like end-to-end transaction tracing, dynamic baselining, troubleshooting and control, and database visibility. That's what it's about. It's about an IoT growth. It's going to bind in with the IoT backend so that when people write IoT apps, they can use Cisco's App Dynamics to monitor the performance of their IoT apps.
Your take is a little interesting to me because this seems like directly an enterprise software play, because AppDynamics was targeting companies who run these big expensive applications and need to monitor them and find ways to improve performance. So I'm surprised it's not in their enterprise business unit, but maybe that's because the enterprise business unit is just focused on selling boxes.
And they've tried selling software for the better part of 12 years. You know, like since 2001, they've tried to buy it. They've done things like Tidal, and they've made several billion-dollar acquisitions into the Declation market, but just never been successful with them. I don't think that folding it into enterprise would actually get them anywhere. It wouldn't move the needle in any way.
Okay, so they're sending it to a different unit that may have some more success working with software customers.
Well, I think that the point is that if you bring this AppDynamics into Cisco, where is it going to get into the channel? So where are you going to get growth? So if you're paying $3.7 billion for something, where is that revenue going to, where are you going to pay for that? And that's not the enterprise. Cisco's not going to be seen as a developer. You know, the customers that buy New Relic don't normally talk to Cisco.
Right. Yeah. It's definitely a different customer base for them.
Yeah, that's right. Or, you know, those types of customers are talking to developers. Well, if you're talking to developers, they're much likely to be in the IoT BU, which is the future market. I think this is much more of a long-term play for Cisco to try and boost that IoT and work with the people who want to build IoT across their platform.
Yeah, and if you had told me that Cisco was in the market for an application performance company, I would have thought, okay, they're going to buy somebody that builds an appliance that, you know, watches network traffic to do your application and network performance monitoring. But that's not the way they went. They went straight software. And this can be delivered software or software as a service. So not even touching a box.
Yeah, you can't monitor application performance in the network in the era of hybrid cloud. So if you've got some of your apps in a public cloud and some of your apps in a private cloud, tools like Cisco's Tetration, which is a classic in-network application monitoring play, are going to struggle to get full visibility. You have to be building it into the app to make this scale. In the case of IoT, when all of your endpoints are littered all across the internet, your smartwatches, your apps, you know, people walking around the factory floor with some sort of iPad or tablet technology, you want to monitor the application performance on the shop floor. Well, again, you're not going to do that in the network. That's just way too difficult. You want to be doing that in the app itself.
Right. And my larger point was that this is a clear signal, in fact, a $3.7 billion signal, that they are serious about software because, as I said, they could have bought an appliance company to do performance monitoring.
They could have bought any one of the companies in that market. And in fact, they've bought several over the years. The old Armon, I'm trying to think of the names. And again, none of those have been overly successful. And in fact, many of them don't exist today. The businesses have just been stripped and folded into, people just went away and the money sort of disappeared. So only about, you know, 50% of these acquisitions ever go anywhere. So who knows? When you're a $20 billion,
you make some bets and they don't always pay off.
Yeah.
But this is a new business for them that absolutely does not revolve around shipping boxes. So
yeah,
they're serious about it.
So there was one post from a company called Axios, which is looking into the financial side of it. There's a favorite company called Catalyst with a Q that Cisco seems to buy an awful lot of companies from, related to, seems to be very personal, like seem to be strong personal relationships. But apparently what happened was as soon as the word for AppDynamics got into the market, Catalyst kind of popped up and went to Cisco and said, you should think about buying this. And then what happened, of course, is that AppDynamics was heading for a float.
They were going to go public. Yeah.
But they had big banks, you know, lined up to do the float. Then they went private. So apparently the big banks are pretty peeved. They just missed out on their payday. They don't get paid until the float goes off.
That's right.
They'll get some consulting or advisory fees, you know, but they won't get as much money as they would have gotten with arranging finances and selling shares on the share market and sending them out. But that probably drove up the price for Cisco, because if the IPO was imminent and they wanted to take it off the market before it floated, they had to move fast. And so, yes, the price is probably highly inflated. And the other rumor that's floating around is that Microsoft and IBM were also bidding on the company and might have bid it up to the point where Cisco had to pay like hurt bad money for it.
Some serious money.
Not where you want to be. You don't want to be bidding against your competitors and an IPO, and the IPO gives you a deadline.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, because they'll be like, fine, you don't want it. We'll walk away. We're still going public. Everybody's going to get paid.
So the guess is that Cisco's paid over the money for this, but not that Cisco cares. It's got $60 billion offshore, and President Trump is likely to say, bring all that home. Give me a tax holiday.
Yes. Some numbers about this deal. AppDynamic, they raised $314 million in venture capital. And according to an article in Fortune, its final private valuation was $1.9 billion. So for Cisco to take it off the table, $3.7 billion does sound like a premium.
Ow. That's a 10 times exit.
I'm not sure what article I saw, but somewhere it said the VC's got like 100 times return on their investment. So, hey, tip of the hat there.
Yeah, that fund is done for the rest of the year.
That's right.
They can invest in losers for the rest of the year.
Well done, fellas.
Yeah. In fact, they'll probably shut down some companies just to celebrate. Because, you know, why bother?
That's right. Another golden back scratcher.
That's right, yeah.
All right, sticking with Cisco, we were just talking about how Cisco is getting all into software and very serious about software. So let's walk that back for a second, because they just also announced Cisco Sparkboard, which is an actual hardware product. It's a new digital whiteboard. It includes video and audio for meetings and conferences. It's very shiny, sparkly, cool, and all about revamping how meetings are done in the office.
My opinion of meetings in the office via these intelligent whiteboards is pretty thin. I'm really working hard here to care.
Well, the message that they're saying is ease of use. And I've been in meetings where you're waiting around for someone to find the right dongle or to connect to the screen sharing application so they can actually show you all the slides on their laptop or whatever. They're saying you walk in, if you're running the Cisco Spark app, your device will automatically sync. You don't have to worry about anything else. It's just easy, easy, easy.
Sure, just as soon as you've installed the Cisco Spark app on every desktop and every smartphone. And you've actually managed to get like more than one Spark at $5,000 for the small body with $299 a month plus installation, because it's got to be mounted on a wall, right?
Right.
You can wheel it around, but there's not much point in that. You've got to have a wireless network, probably a Cisco wireless network. So you're talking $1,000 a port there. And then you need to have enough WAN bandwidth to make one of these work. So yeah, no, definitely great idea when you've got all of those other things and they all work. Do you know what?
Then it's absolutely, absolutely.
Like 200 a month is 2,500 a year to own this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that effectively the only way that these two things can talk together is to have this cloud platform so that you can find the other units.
Well, that's the more I dug into it, the more I was like, okay, wait a minute, because it does require that you buy into and subscribe to a Cisco cloud platform for this digital whiteboard because of the fact that you can take whatever you draw on the whiteboard and save it and share it, et cetera. So it's got to be cloud-based. And also the fact that you do need to have Cisco Spark apps on your laptop or smartphones to make this work.
Yeah. So you're talking about a five-year cost, $30,000 for one unit. All right. So let's say you need five of them for five meeting rooms or five offices. Then you're talking $150,000 over 5 years. Not including the cost of the client licenses. So the Cisco Spark app may or may not be free. It could be. You've probably got to have Cisco Spark licenses, and they're $25 per month per endpoint. So there's Spark licenses for the clients as well, and probably a license fee for the Spark platform. So I think it's a little disingenuous to say only $5,000 to get started.
Assuming you have all of the other pieces in place.
Assume you have a wireless network, WAN bandwidth, and $200 a month. Plus, you have somebody who can support the software. You know, the software's in the cloud, but you don't have to install the video, blah, blah, blah. So it's not cheap, is basically what I'm trying to say. But it does look pretty sexy. It looks like a fairly modern screen. And I watched a couple of YouTube videos from various people, Cisco fans, drawing on it and generally getting pretty excited. It looks really good, right?
It does look really good, yeah.
I have pretty much worked whiteboards out of my workflow. In all honesty, I find it easier just to draw directly into a diagramming tool like OmniGraph or Visio than to get on a whiteboard and then copy it all into Visio.
Right.
Or you can just share screens. You can use Cisco Spark to share screens. Really? You need to get up on a big board? That sounds like some sort of erectile dysfunction thing to have a big screen to talk on.
Oh, I don't think so. I think whiteboards are here to stay. And whether digital whiteboards are, I don't know, but I think whiteboards are useful.
Sure, I'm weird. I know.
Yeah, you have your very own specific tastes. Nothing wrong with that.
I'm a little bit jubilous. I do think this is a very sparkly, very glamorous. Cisco's, you know, done some pretty good glamorous things here. It's a very exciting technology in a way, but I'm not sure that, you know, smart whiteboards have been around for going on 15 years And I'm not sure if this significantly moves the needle or the price point.
Well, Cisco hasn't had a problem charging people a lot of money for things and getting them to buy it. So who knows? We'll see.
Oh, yeah. And their collaboration business unit does continue to grow at 10% per quarter.
It does. It does.
Maybe people like it.
Maybe they're onto something.
Maybe they'll work out how much it costs later on.
And they can add it up on the whiteboard and then save it to the cloud.
Well, there's a purpose for a whiteboard.
All right, we'll take a quick break to thank our sponsor, Interop ITX, where tech pros go to get objective, full-stack education. It's taking place May 15th through 19th at the MGM in Las Vegas. And hey, Greg Farrow, Ethan Banks, and me are going to be on site for the Future of Networking Summit. Greg, what is that?
The Networking Summit is sort of like the Packet Pushers Conference we always wanted to have, but can't be bothered doing.
That's right.
We've looked into it a couple of times, but really, partnering with Interop ITX is really the way forward for us. So we're going to be there May 15th to 17th, 15th and 16th. That's the Monday and the Tuesday. We're going to be presenting our own 2 days. We'd love for you to come along, right? And we're going to be talking about our unique take on WAN, data center, operations, and software-defined security. But once you're already there, then you've got 3 more days to join in the rest of the conference. So there'll be other hands-on workshops like the Future of Data, Container Crash Course, Cybersecurity Summit. There's a whole bunch of other stuff. If you check out their website, you can find out a lot more about the whole IT program that's going on. It's very strategy, very forward-looking focused, a bit like what we talk about here on the show. So if you're looking to accelerate your career, there's also plenty of sessions on leadership and professional development. So if you're feeling a need to lift yourself emotionally and as a leader, lots of stuff there for the boss. So you might want to drag him along too, or her. Plus, check out over 100 vendors at Interop's ITX Business Hall, where you'll have the opportunity to see what leading and emergency tech vendors have to offer. I do want to say that Interop's approach to the show floor is very different from previous years. It's going to be much more practical, and I'm actually quite excited. Join us at Interop ITX this coming May. It's just 4 months away. Use the promo code PACKETPUSHERS when you register, and you'll get 20% off. Go over interopitx.com and reserve your spot. We want to see you in Vegas.
Thanks, Interop ITX, and we hope to see you at the MGM in Las Vegas in May. Back to the news, HPE, they've announced that they're buying Cloud Cruiser. That measures cloud consumption for private and public cloud usage. There wasn't a disclosure on how much it paid, but apparently HPE has already been licensing Cloud Cruiser's technology for its own flexible capacity offering, and I guess they liked it so much they decided to buy it.
Yeah. What's that company that makes the razors? Right. What are they called? It does sound like that. I got the sense, you know, I can't shake the feeling. I did some searches but couldn't find it. The HP bought a company that did this a while back, when it was all decided that the best way to control the cloud was to monitor how much was being consumed. But maybe that didn't go anywhere, and maybe old HP is very different from new HPE, and this one will work. The fact that they've already got a product that's been going between them might be a good hallmark that actually owning it, and they can exploit it to its fullest and get a return on their investment. Certainly seems to be a smarter buy than previous ones.
Yes, they do seem to be very careful with who they're picking up. I mean, the fact that they're already licensing it themselves to use it for, you know, as a back end on their own product, they've obviously had some time to dig in.
Yeah, it's a good, probably know where the skeletons are, so this makes sense. And generally, the response to their acquisition that we talked about last week with Simplivity seems to have been very positive. I've been tracking different blog posts and different websites, and the general sense is that HPE's done a good buy there to pick up that product. So as it said, there's three, basically, of the first of the hyperconverged companies. There was Nutanix, Simplivity, and Scale. Nutanix, of course, IPO'd. Simplivity has now been acquired by HP, leaving Scale Computing as the last of the first generation of hyperconverged out there. And they claim that they're getting to profitability. So
we shall see. And just a note about flexible capacity, that's the HPE product that they were using with Cloud Cruiser, and I hadn't heard of it before. I guess what it actually does is let customers pay for on-premises infrastructure as they would in the cloud, i.e. pay as you go, and flexible capacity kind of monitors and meters it, and that's what they're using Cloud Cruiser for. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, HPE has a large number of customers for whom they manage their entire IT infrastructure. Over the years, they've been bidding to say, you know, don't worry about it, we'll just do the whole thing. And they actually subcontract in heads and then sell all the parts and, you know, take over the WAN, take over the data center, help desk everything, just turn the whole thing into a HPE, top to bottom, left to right. They sell in there whatever they choose for a given solution. They may use other people's storage or other people's networking if that's what's required, but otherwise they'll use their own, et cetera, et cetera. If you're wanting to do consumption-based IT for that on-prem stuff, that's a good way to continue that highly profitable business, right?
Absolutely.
Because you've got total customer control at that point.
That's right. And then you closely meter and monitor it.
Yeah, and bill. Yeah.
Always bill. Always be billing.
That doesn't happen for free.
That's right. Facebook, they are announcing new support for its open hardware and software platforms, including news that Cumulus Networks, their network OS Cumulus Linux, is now going to run on the Facebook Wedge and Facebook Backpack switches. Wedge is fixed line configuration switches, and Backpack is a big honking chassis switch.
Yeah, so there's actually several announcements come out of this conference. They had a disaggregate conference, which was at Facebook. It's not the sort of conference that you and I can go to.
No.
It's strictly invitation only, and it's about the size of a classroom. So
it's all the cool kids.
It's all the cool kids get to go, and they're all in Silicon Valley, and who can afford to go there? But I'm looking forward to seeing the videos post up on YouTube. They normally release them. It's really quite a wide spectrum of news, and I'll try and run down them very quickly. First of all, Cumulus Networks is now running on top of the Wedge 100. So that's a chassis. That's a 13 terabits per second of Ethernet. So if you wanted an alternative to your existing chassis-based solutions from Brocade, Juniper, Cisco, now you got one.
That's the Backpack, not the Wedge.
Sorry, yes. The Backpack, which is a big honkin' and, the, you know...
Eight rack units large.
Eight rack units of 40 gig, 100 gig, and even more, right? There's a second gen as well. Cumulus Networks, which was everybody said they were just going to run on one RU, for them to get to a chassis sort of a system, they must have really invested in their software and hardware capabilities to port their operating system for a different platform. So that's really exciting to see, to be honest, in a real way, because Cumulus can now do the biggest spines possible. And I'm sure some of their customers. We had Big Switch talk about the release of their operating system for the Wedge 40 and Wedge 100. They are most commonly Big Switch partners and Cumulus partner with Dell for the network hardware as like a preferred partnership. But Big Switch and Cumulus both produce for Open Compute because a lot of their customers are asking for that as well.
And there are folks like EdgeCore who are taking those Open Compute designs and building out switches based on it.
EdgeCore is a recurring theme here.
It is.
EdgeCore is the company that's making Backpack and Wedges for people because we also saw that for Barefoot Networks.
That's right. It was EdgeCore that makes a wedge for the Barefoot Tofino, yeah.
So now what you're seeing is Barefoot Networks, of course, they've made an ASIC, which is very interesting because it's a programmable forwarding plane, a bit like what you see in big end routers, except now it's going to be in a switch architecture. The way that the ASIC is programmed requires a new approach, so now we're waiting for software to come. But what Barefoot's has done is EdgeCore is now manufacturing switches with, or has announced that it's manufacturing switches, so that a little bit of a difference. They'll be coming, but announced that the Wedge will have a Tofino in it so that there is a hardware reference platform for you to start developing against.
That's right.
Which is significant. So they talked about that at Facebook, and I think that it being in a Wedge is important to the MSDCs, which is the Megascale Data Center Providers. They'll be looking at Barefoot as a way to do high services in the network, or even more importantly, flexible services, so they can change the network and reprogram it. There's still lots of runway that needs to happen here, so don't imagine that you can run around. It might be a year or two, but that's an interesting thing is that Barefoot made a chip, got it shipped, and now they've got a switch running it already.
And there was also news from SnapRoute around Facebook and its Wedge platform.
We hear so much about SnapRoute, and particularly they've been open sourcing their protocol implementations, OSPF, BGP, MPLS, and so forth. They've now announced their Flex Switch software, which is an operating system that allows their apps to run in like a microservices architecture. That software can now power Voyager and the open optical stuff we talked about some months ago. So basically, they announced their software. It runs on everything, including the optical stuff. All of a sudden, we're starting to see software abstracted away from hardware. So the hardware can develop on one pace and the software can develop on another pace. That's the value of abstraction, is that the hardware can iterate at the speed of hardware. And the software can iterate at the speed of software, and we don't have to wait. The hardware is the slowest one, so we don't have software features running at a snail's pace compared to the hardware release. That's the advantage here. So that's why we're seeing so many of these announcements happen. Software companies can iterate very quickly. So the idea that SnapRoute could take their software and suddenly run it on an open optical platform is kind of like, boom, that's what you get when you disaggregate these things.
Yeah, and speaking of hardware, Cavium also announced an XPliant platform for the Open Compute from Facebook.
Again, so the Wedge 100C, which the C stands for Cavium, as opposed to the Wedge 100B, standing for Barefoot. So just remember that when you're talking to your favorite provider. We talked about Cavium early in the year. They'd already produced a version of their XPliant ASIC. Their silicon is programmable as well. So unlike the Broadcom silicon, which is not programmable, Cavium and Barefoot both have programmable silicon. But Barefoot's probably more programmable, but we can have a different argument about that another day. So they've announced a second generation of their switch, based around a subsequent version of their CNX88091. Really? Come on, people. Can't you just come up with ordinary numbers? Honestly, just pick a name. Anyway, I mean, Intel does this as well. E25-9061, XBA. So it's a pain in the butt. So yes, more hardware. Again, this hardware developing at a pace that suits Cavium and Barefoot, and the software is developing in a completely different direction.
These are indeed interesting times.
Yeah, and of course, Apstra got a version of their orchestration system. I'll call it an orchestration system. They call it intent-based operating system. And they've now demonstrated it working with the Wedge 100. That's the Broadcom version and the FBOSS software that runs on the top. So that's very good for them. I like the team at Apstra. I like the idea of what they're doing. They're competing hard against a range of other companies here. For those of you who know what the difference between orchestration and automation, you should be looking at AOS.
From Apstra, yes.
Yes.
And we even have a podcast with them, so we could find a link to that.
We did, yes. Full disclosure.
Right. As always, we're being upfront.
Yes. Full disclosure. They did sponsor us at some point, but yes.
All right. Yeah, we'll throw a link to that in the show notes if you're interested. But moving on with the news, this is a story that we're a little behind on because it fell in between a couple of recording dates. But Avaya has officially declared Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And according to Reuters, Avaya is carrying $6.3 billion in debt, and they're looking to restructure loans with their creditors.
So no surprise. We talked about this back in December that it was struggling. The buyout is largely due to the fact that when it was bought out by private venture capital in 2008, like a fair while back, they loaded it up with billions of dollars worth of debt. Why did they load it up with debt? That's easy. Because when you load them up with debt, you take fees on the debt raising. So then what you do is, you know, you go in, you load them up with debt, and then you pay out a dividend. So I get a dividend, and then I get fees on giving them debt. That's why they do it. But what's happening is it was all predicated on the fact that the model would continue for another 10 years to pay down the debt. And of course, the transition to software means a drop in revenues. The software defined means a drop in revenues as hardware sales tail off, but software revenues don't kick in for a long time. It takes a year or two for the revenue to be recovered over time. The business is not broken. You don't need to suddenly turn away and start looking for others. It's not going to go away, is what everybody's saying. I'm not in a position to judge how true that is, but the consensus seems to be amongst the people who do that AVA is in fine form. It just needs to refinance its debt, but wasn't able to unless it went into Chapter 11. And that's a function of how the US accounting works. You can go into Chapter 11 and do this. It's not a full bankruptcy. It's like a pre-bankruptcy just to turn the company around.
Okay, so they're waiting for software revenues to catch up in this transition from hardware to software. And in the meantime, they've got to restructure debt to stay viable.
They had notes coming due and they just didn't have the cash to pay for it. They've got revenue and got good forward projections of revenue. But so in America, what you do is you go into Chapter 11, negotiate with your creditors, restructure your debt, pay it out over a longer period and so forth, and then come back out again. You may get that in other countries, but most countries don't do it that way.
Mm-hmm. All right, moving on. Gartner Group, it's the analyst firm that Greg loves to hate. They're acquiring a company called CEB for $2.6 billion in cash and stock. CEB is an analyst firm that advises executives on talent management and business operations. When I read between the lines of that description, I think it means they help business leaders squeeze the most performance they can out of employees.
It's not too often you hear business leaders called talent. My words for them are not normally repeatable in public places, but hey, I'm trying to remember what CEB stands for. Just write CEB everywhere.
I have no idea.
No, the whole press release just says CEB as if we're supposed to know what this is all about. Pretty weird. It's like corporate executive something. Who cares?
Yeah.
Anyway, $2.9 billion. Awash Gartner's like awash with cash.
$2.6 billion.
Yeah. So wants to waste it away. Has a total enterprise value of $3.3 billion. Including Gartner's assumption of approximately $0.7 billion in net debt. Who knew? So obviously you people are giving Gartner so much money that they can afford to do this. Well
yeah,
done you.
Surprised.
Yeah. Just in case you didn't have enough Gartner, there's more Gartner than ever before.
That's a lot of analyzing.
Yes. Yes. Obviously people like advice and they love paying for it. You know, we must be in the wrong market. That's the only reason this article is here, by the way, just so I could say that.
Very good.
Feel free to throw money at me. The day I've got $700 million in debt and somebody buys me with that amount of debt, I'll know I've made it.
That's right. That's right. We'll charge you extra. All right. Speaking of charging, another word from our sponsor, INE. Do you need training? INE has an incredible library of over 8,500 network training videos designed for the network engineer with a hands-on focus. As I mentioned earlier, the offerings include CCENT and CCIE, plus Wireshark, SDN, Juniper, and more. You get to watch from any device, including iOS, Android, tablets, PCs, even Apple TV. You can download most courses a la carte and DRM free. You can even get hands-on experiences by renting INE Rack Time. That's pretty cool. And be sure to check out the All Access Pass. That's one subscription. It gets you the entire collection of courses, and it's only $999 a year. That's over 330 network-specific courses, and this training is approximately 70% hands-on demonstration at the command line or a UI. This is not death by PowerPoint. The content in these courses is structured for the network engineer, so if you're looking to get training, check out INE. And here's a special deal. You can get 15% off any product or 15% off the All Access Pass by going to ine.com/packet and using the code packet. Thanks, INE, for being a sponsor.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Now, INE has been around for like way more than a decade. They started off in the CCNA IE training, and now they're really branching out into all the different forms. So you know that they've been around for a long period of time. And when they say it's all CLI-driven, that's true. They've always been very proud of their labs and the fact that you can do that. Thanks to INE for sponsoring Packet Push. It's been great to see them come on board and tell you about them.
That's right. So check out ine.com/packet if you want that 15% discount. Use the code packet. Okay, back to the news. Greg, this is a story you pulled up. 3D TV is officially dead because Sony and LG are stopping the manufacturing of 3D TV sets.
Yeah, I highlighted this from the point of view. This isn't really enterprise tech, but it is a sort of a salient lesson that even though vendors spend billions making a thing, that doesn't mean thing is successful.
Yes.
And 3D TV had the most unimaginable froth. And you know, like CES a couple of years ago was 3D TV, everybody's going to have one. Oh, that's going to be. And the press and the journalists were all absolutely certain this was going to be the next. You couldn't find anybody who didn't think that 3D TV was going to make it, right? Just absolutely everybody had got themselves. And now where are we, right?
Right.
Yeah. When everybody's in favor of something, just have a close look at it. The answer is, for the price they wanted, I think looking back at 3D TV, quite simply, they wanted enormous prices for it to justify the, you know, the investments they'd made in this technology. They also wanted us to throw out everything that we've got, even though most people just thought that everything was just fine with 2D. Probably the most important thing was that there are a significantly large percentage of the population who simply couldn't watch it. It made them sick.
That's a problem.
Yeah, two things. One, a lot of people reported getting headaches looking at 3D screens because of the eye thing. The second one was some people got nauseous because of the three-dimensional. I watched a couple of 3D films at the movies and just got a headache every time and stopped going. And that to me was clearly like a problem.
3D is that thing like, you know, jetpacks and flying cars that will probably always be something that is coming down the pipe in the future. We just haven't found a way to make it work.
I think VR and AR is probably where it's going to be for the near. Anyway, I just thought I'd highlight that remember what a hype cycle looks like. Let's look back at way 3D TV. Everybody was going to have one. It was enormous. There was, you know, vast sums of money being spent to shove it down your throat, and it's died. And I think there's a lesson, a trenchant lesson to be learned.
Until we get to the level of Star Trek holodecks, I'm just not paying any attention. Once we get there, let me know, and I'll be in. I'm all in on that.
This comes back to my idea. A lot of people watch TV on their iPhones or their iPads.
Mm-hmm.
So why would you buy an 80-inch three-dimensional television? You know, there's just not a big market for this, is what I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
All right, moving on. Windstream, they're a Fortune 500 service provider here in the U.S. They recently announced they're partnering with the startup VeloCloud to offer SD-WAN as a service. The service is targeting enterprise and mid-market customers that want a little more flexibility and control over WAN connections.
Yeah, you're seeing a lot of this sort of stuff coming out. I think we saw...
There were a lot of deals last year with folks like Verizon and Earthlink and some other big names partnering up with startup SD-WAN service providers to offer SD-WAN services to customers.
You know, there's another one this week where NTT PC Communications, which is a telecommunications carrier in Japan, is announcing their managed cloud network service. We're using Viptela's SD-WAN platform. Pretty much this has gotten to the point where I am ignoring these because so many carriers are building these SD-WAN managed services that it's sort of become like every day. I mean, I think if I look back in the announcements, you'll see between Viptela, VeloCloud, Cloudgenix, and you know, the managed service providers are all over this product like flies around a can of poop. That should be a telling story to just about every enterprise and that's listening.
Yeah, I mean, I think they see that this market is real. They want to be a part of it, make sure they're not sidelined and shut out and just turn into dumb pipes. If they have a service, they can offer it and stay in touch with the customer.
That's right, yeah. So it's all about bypassing the underlay. So whatever it is, the physical service that's underneath, managed providers can build networks on top of anything, and that gives them the ability to bypass the weaknesses of the physical underlay long for lead times, expensive. Sometimes they only want to sell you a legacy tech. You know, one carrier wants to offer you a 45 meg DS3, but you could go and get like a gigabit internet service for the same money. Well, why aren't you using that sort of thing? So a managed service providers desperately need to modernize. They've got all sorts of problems with their legacy business models. They've all been struggling. I imagine they're like, when you don't offer a glass of water to a drowning man, give him a stick and he'll jump on it. I think this is what we're seeing.
Yeah, I think so too. All right, our last story for this episode, some financial results from F5 Networks. Of course, they make load balancers, ADCs, and other networking products. They reported revenues of $516 million for the quarter. That's a rise of 5.4% over the previous year. And their quarterly income was $94.2 million.
Yeah, so I was just to get a second read on this, I was reading George Notter from Jefferies, who is a major financial analyst. He basically says that F5 has come up with solid results and guidance. So originally when they announced it, there was a sell-off, a 3.3% drop, but now fundamentally people realized that it was just saying the growth hasn't come in the way they thought. So they've spent 2016 refreshing their product. They've got a whole new hardware and software portfolio. They've got virtual devices. Now what? Are customers buying it? Not quite yet. So we're just going to have to wait and see. He says that the risk of F5's share price is balanced. So they're executing well. The stock had a 49% run-up last year. There's no more to go. So fine. Great.
And one highlight that jumped out for me, their product revenue was up 2% year over year, which kind of reverses a trend in which we've been seeing tech companies getting more out of service revenue than product revenue. But this quarter, F5 kind of bucked that trend.
Yeah, I think so. I think that F5 has done a good job of convincing the existing install base to keep buying its products. You know, much like Cisco has done a great job of that and all of the other incumbent vendors. But the growth hasn't really happened for them as people trail off or slow down their purchases to move to the cloud. So, you know, the balance between retaining customers with new, more expensive products and trailing off to the cloud kind of evens out across the board. That's what we've seen with Cisco's enterprise sales. We've seen it with Juniper sort of, you know, holding steady. That's the change that we've talked about a lot. And none of the evidence we are seeing suggests a change yet. So when people said the revenues were down, but profit margins were up, there was a sell-off, but it's since recovered. So F5 is probably fine. Just let them roll. There's no upside. There's no downside.
That's right. And we'll be sure to check in next quarter and see how it's going. But that wraps it up for this episode of Network Break. Greg, if folks want more from you, how can they get it?
You can find me on packetpushers.net, where I'll be blogging some stuff. I also just wrote some articles for our newsletter. If you want our newsletter, head on over to packetpushers.net/human-infrastructure, where you can sign up to join us. I'm working on YouTube content, but I recorded a YouTube video yesterday only to realize that it just wasn't good enough. I actually had cat hair all over my jacket. Oh. And the camera's so good, you can actually see the
hair.
So I had to delete all of that, and so I'll be back having another go at that. We've got a very busy week of recording this week, of course. We've got lots of podcasts in the pipeline.
All right. Note to self, doing video, invest in a lint brush.
Yes, or don't wear a fleece. Don't wear a dark fleece. Yeah, don't wear a dark fleece where you... Don't wear a dark fleece when you've got white cats.
Right. I'm Drew Conry Murray. You can find me on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I blog at packetpushers.net. Thanks so much to our sponsors, Interop, ITX, and INE. We'll have links to them in the show notes. And thank you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you enjoy the show, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share a link with your colleagues. Be sure to check out all the fine, free technical content over at packetpushers.net. Tons of podcasts, tons of articles, and of course, our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine, and Link Propagation. Thanks for listening.